Welcome back for the final panel of the afternoon. I'm Ronna Freiberg, and it's my pleasure as a former USIA-er to moderate the panel on the future of public diplomacy. You'll note that none of us has a PowerPoint this afternoon, so pay close attention. Before I introduce our distinguished panelists, I'm going to make a couple of comments about public diplomacy, and I'm actually going to begin with a definition. Coming at the end of the day, it may be something we should have done at the beginning of the day, but nonetheless, public diplomacy is the effort to understand, inform, engage, and persuade foreign publics in ways that support our national interests. Public diplomacy utilizes ideas, culture, relationships, and values to attract cooperation rather than military force to coerce it. Public diplomacy, therefore, really is essential to what we've been calling smart power all day long. There are, I would say, and I know there are folks in the audience who can carry on this discussion in great detail, three essential elements in public diplomacy. The first is the dissemination of information. Today, we use both traditional and new media for that purpose. Secondly, is direct interaction with individuals and organizations, including educational institutions, on the ground in communities beyond our borders. We call that the field operation, but it is much more than most Americans realize. And thirdly, public diplomacy includes a broad range of academic, professional, cultural, and citizen exchange programs. Many of those have been discussed today. Now, that means that educational cultural exchange is an important element of public diplomacy, and public diplomacy, in turn, is an important element of smart power. Over the past 5 years, there have been no fewer than a dozen reports issued by think tanks, commissions, government organizations, looking at how to improve our standing in the world and how to strengthen public diplomacy. Some have suggested, and I hope our panelists will address this, that State Department is simply not equipped to face and carry out our communications challenges, nor is it equipped to deal with, to take advantage of the talent and the resources in the private sector and in the academic community. Others disagree. I hope that our panelists will have something to say about that, and I'm sure many of you in the audience who were part of these studies may have comments as well. So let me turn to our panelists with a brief introduction, and we'll go on from there. I need not say much about Tom Pickering. You all know he is a former ambassador to 6 countries and the UN. He is a member of the Smart Power Commission, Undersecretary of State in the Clinton administration, and he has led several important studies on global engagement. Secondly, Goli Amery, who was the Assistant Secretary of State for Educational and Cultural Exchange in the Bush administration, also former UN Commissioner, delegate to the UN Commission on Human Rights. And thirdly, Ann Witkowski, who was a director of defense policy and arms control in the NSC in the Clinton administration, now a senior associate at CSIS. Our rules of the game are each panelist will talk for not more than 15 minutes, and then we'll move to questions at the end. Our microphone capability is limited, so I'm going to pass the mic on to Ambassador Pickering.
Thank you, Ronna, very much, and thank you for including me in the panel. It's nice to see that you finally got the gender balance right. I'm very pleased to be here and delighted to speak to you about some of the things that have been on my mind for some time with respect to public diplomacy, its operation, and its organization. Let me begin by saying I think it's an essential part of our national effort in diplomacy writ large, and in dealing with foreign states. There's no question at all in my mind that it should play a much more significant role in what we are doing than it has, and that in discussing public diplomacy, I want to talk a little bit about the public diplomacy policy debate and issues. I want to talk a little bit about organization and where and how it might fit, and then a little bit about public diplomacy program for the future, and hopefully I can wind all of that up well before my 15-minute clock runs out. Let me also say that over the years, I've had the opportunity in many different posts and in many different places to work with public diplomacy officers. And in fact, even before I was in the Foreign Service, my wife was, and she was a public diplomacy officer, so at least in the sinister side of this issue, I married into the public diplomacy cone, if not really achieved much on my own. My sense is that public diplomacy is, of course, extremely important in Rana's very extensive definition to be able to convey to foreign audiences what the United States is really about, what it is, what it seeks, where it intends to go, and how, and obviously, it sees itself fitting into the world scheme of things. And without that, we found both during the Cold War and after, we were very much at a loss. There is, of course, been a view, I think probably a somewhat malign view, that good public diplomacy can fix almost any foreign policy. We know, in fact, that it doesn't work very well, that, in fact, you have to choose your foreign policies wisely and put them forward wisely to receive the benefits of the kind of synergy that that, in fact, makes evident in terms of the way we are dealing with this issue. My feeling has been for a long period of time, however, that over the years, as I watched foreign policy get made both in embassies abroad and in Washington, that there is a significant role for public diplomacy in effectively making foreign policy. And I watched assistant secretaries and deputy assistant secretaries and indeed country directors, as they put together foreign policy, ask themselves a number of really quite critical questions. How and in what way will this policy be received in country X? Not just only by those people who were setting the foreign policy of country X, but very often the wiser ones asked, how will it be received in public? And indeed, the play between public reception and official reception at high level has always been significant in our willingness to judge whether a particular foreign policy would, in fact, have salience and be attractive. Not only that, I think that over the years, the better policymakers attempted to present the policy, both inside the U.S. government and external to the U.S. government, in ways that attempted to take into account, through their own knowledge of the country, their country knowledge of the cultures, how and in what way particular efforts would work. And embassies played a large role in it, and people in close touch in the field were very significant in obviously trying to work that side of the issue. Not all American foreign policy choices are home runs in public diplomacy. We know that. And not all can be attuned. But each ought to be, in my view, examined in a very careful way. And I think over the years, the foreign policy makers generally took those particular factors into account. There was a second set of obvious issues that gets us right up against the Smith-Mundt borderline. How and in what way will a particular policy be received in the United States? And while the Foreign Service was sort of abjured from thinking about domestic politics in the fashioning of foreign policy, it often thought about domestic public affairs in fashioning foreign policy. And the two were not necessarily congruent, what was going to play well overseas and what was going to play well in the United States. And, of course, at the top, the cupola of foreign policy making, the President and the Secretary of State also had very much to worry about these issues and how they should be attuned. I think that in many ways, too, it was the ability of the United States to create an organization and indeed a group of personnel that understood not only our foreign policy and how it was made, but understood foreign cultures very well, and particularly at the grassroots, but also at fairly high levels, that helped us to move that. When USIA was folded into the State Department, It was a sincere hope that it would play a larger role in policymaking through its location in the regional bureaus and be more effective in helping assistant secretaries and those who worked with them in the regional bureaus to think more about how and in what way our foreign policies could not only be crafted but more effectively presented. This doesn't mean, of course, that the objective of foreign policy is to craft a foreign policy that will sell well overseas. American interests are still the predominant piece. But it is interesting as you look at the history of foreign policy making how much small changes, in particular both in the presentation of foreign policy and in the ways, obviously, of putting it together, can make and do have a more positive influence on its saleability. So I think that that is important. The world is not going to be turned upside down, obviously, and put all of the public diplomacy folks in charge of foreign policy. But I do think that we need to continue to tax the foreign policy makers with the notion that public diplomacy is a very significant part of their task. When I was undersecretary, we sent a cable to all American ambassadors within, I think, my first 6 months in office, maybe not. And we said, in effect, you should realize, if you don't already, that American foreign policy that's being sent to you in the cables in the form of talking points, and which I think is a malign way to present foreign policy, is being presented to you in the main by very smart people who have to clear this all around the government. So what you get is really a kind of sausage, which you don't see in the making, but involves all those awful pieces you wouldn't want to see when it comes out. And indeed, the way of presenting foreign policy as talking points emphasizes the worst aspects of the sausage, in my view, because people spend infinite amounts of time clearing words that hopefully, as I said in the cable, you ambassadors will never use. I said, you earn your munificent salaries as ambassadors by taking what it is we send you and crafting it in a way that is most likely to succeed with foreign governments. And indeed, in my whole history, those people who had been ambassadors for more than 2 hours began to understand that going in and reading the talking points was perhaps sudden death in many, many different ways. And you had to find a way to take the talking points, stay faithful to the policy, and indeed make the presentation in a way that was successful. And we ended the bottom of the cable saying, this doesn't give you license to change the policy, but it sure gives you license to figure out what's the best way to present it in your own country. And to some extent, that is where public diplomacy and foreign policy come together. And no one in the chain is immune, in my view, to the influences and indeed the importance of the brief that the others hold and how it works. And so my feeling is there needs to be very close interchange. There needs to be a very close relationship. The public diplomacy tail doesn't wag the policy dog, but we all know that the policy dog has a big public diplomacy tail and ought to be paying attention to it. That takes me to my second point, which is the vexed and trying issue of how should we organize ourselves to conduct public diplomacy. My view is that we are now back in the Winston Churchill conundrum. Having tried everything else, I hope we're about to produce what we think is a better answer than all the ones that we have tried so badly in the past. My feeling is that the close relationship between public diplomacy and policy requires an integration within, I would call, the larger Department of State of public diplomacy. That's not a popular view among professionals in the public diplomacy arena, but I think it makes a certain amount of sense. But let me tell you what I think the other side of the story is. For a whole set of reasons, I believe that it is time to organize what would be a standalone agency within the Department of State to conduct public diplomacy for a whole series of reasons. And my sense of the organizational model is something like two I'll give you as examples. One, for a number of years, our friends in the Defense Department have had a number of standalone agencies within the Defense Department. The Defense Advanced Research and Projects Agency, for one, which along with Al Gore is given shared credit for developing the Internet, is an example of this, the Defense Security Assistance Agency, another. I believe we need a separate agency in state for a number of reasons. And I would say the other example is what has happened with the morphing of aid closer to the Secretary of State as an organization without, in fact, injuring in any way the agency's internal cohesion to deal with a number of problems that it has to deal with. A standalone agency for public diplomacy, in my view, would do several things. One, it would treat as serious and important the fact that this is a different kind of function than traditional diplomacy. Secondly, it would provide a solid personnel strength with an agency behind it to look after people in the public diplomacy cone. So we knew, in fact, that they were both being chosen and assigned on the basis that they would maintain some integrity in their career life, if I could put it that way, and not distributed all around the State Department to do jobs that were not related to what they were doing. Now, I would emphasize, I think there is always room for rotation, but not permanent reassignment. And I think rotation is useful for both political and economic and even admin and consular officers to the public diplomacy cone for once in a while, and vice versa. But I think we need to keep the integrity. Thirdly, like AID, public diplomacy involves a great deal of program execution. And program execution is not something that necessarily traditional State Department officers either aspire to or do very well. And without special preparation and training and without serious experience through a long career in public diplomacy, your ability to operate effectively public diplomacy programs is very much a question of doubt unless you have been there and done that and grown up in the practice of that kind of effort. I think, fourthly, there is a kind of elan, a special spirit, and indeed a cultural affinity among public diplomacy officers, which we lost without thinking about it at all at the time we tried to blend USIA into the State Department. And it's time, in my view, to get that back. They come from a different background. In a sense, they aspire to different objectives. They have different skills. And there's no reason at all why, in fact, in the old traditional British Army regimental system, that should not be part of their ethos. Well, that's at least one set of ideas. I differ a little bit on some minor organizational questions with some of my friends who come out of the public diplomacy cone, but I won't torture you with those small differences here. They are not, in my view, serious or consequential. Whether we could ever get to a new standalone agency is a question of some doubt for me, but I'm happy to go at it incrementally if indeed that will work, and we will have to solve some problems as to whether personnel assignments and separate budgets are either part of the central structure or part of the new agency. Again, I think that can be argued either way. Effectiveness should be the major criteria for deciding that particular effort. I think finally, with respect to programs, I would only say this. I think that the lady who sits to my right, to your left, has run one of the most important programs we have in the U.S. government. Over the years, I and my fellow Foreign Service officers benefited enormously from the fact that we had, over the years, exchange programs and study programs in the United States, and a great number of our foreign colleagues, both diplomats and politicians, were indeed graduates of those programs. And I can think maybe of one or two cases in a long career where, in fact, they turned out not to like the United States, but in the main, they did. They were not uncritical. Indeed, we taught them to be critical, and we were a success. But at the same time, they knew and understood the balance of interests, and they had a personal experience in this country which ratified for them what we stood for and what we should be standing for and gave them a sense of the basis on which to make judgments about our foreign policy. So I think that the efforts to bring back those programs, which suffered over the years with budget cuts and, unfortunately, with some success in the Cold War, are, in my view, seriously wrongheaded and badly mistaken. And we need long-term programs, whether they're cultural exchanges, whether they're libraries, whether they are new media efforts to reach out in the blogosphere, which I think is extremely important and which we have to get on top of and obviously use effectively and devote ourselves and our funding to in order to make those go ahead. So I'm in favor of those kinds of approaches. It may sound very simplistic, But without a long-range investment in public diplomacy to people who may never, in fact, ever come again to the United States, we will never get those who, in fact, will turn out to be some of our best partners in countries around the world. So let me stop there. I'm certainly exhausted my 15 minutes and your patience, and I look forward to your questions.
Okay, first of all, I want to thank CSIS for convening this really important meeting and also the Alliance for being superb partners of the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs at the State Department, as well as ETS for working so hard for bringing all these wonderful foreign students to the United States, myself one of them. You know, I know we are here to discuss the future of public diplomacy, but if you might bear with me for a moment, I'd like to briefly sort of talk to you about the immediate past, not because I like to relive the past, because I do, but also because I think it really sort of sets the stage for a proposal and an idea that I'd like to put on the table. And I'm really delighted that I'm coming after Ambassador Pickering, because this idea sort of dovetails nicely into this agency that he was just talking about. I had a relatively lengthy confirmation process, so I had a lot of time on my hand to really get an understanding of what the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs does and all the important activities that it's involved in. And what I ended up learning, especially because the Bureau has a very strong evaluation arm, is that indeed, just as the ambassador said, the programs of ECA really do move the needle in terms of the U.S. image abroad. And when you really think about the fact that every year the Bureau touches somewhere between 20 to 25,000 foreign nationals in one way or another, and every one of these people during their lifespans influence another 20 up to millions of people in their lifetime, you can really see that, you know, that this Bureau does some pretty amazing, important things. So what I was thinking about was, okay, we know we have a Bureau here that does some pretty important programs. How can we amplify these programs? In fact, the previous undersecretary and I sort of codified this new word called massify, and we were trying to figure out how do we massify and amplify some of the ECA's programs. So ended up really focusing on three major areas. One was partnering with the private sector so that, you know, we know that the budget is not going to increase more than anywhere between 5 to 8% per year. So bringing private sector partners in to help us with these programs. Second was by using Web 2.0 technologies, using the internet to get out to, reach out to many, many more people. And then thirdly was using and harnessing the goodwill that the alumni of ECA's programs that the ambassador just talked about. So starting out with these public-private partnerships, you know, we know that corporations are doing some incredible philanthropic work around the world as part of their corporate social responsibility objectives. And what we learned is that a lot of the things that they're doing really actually aligns strategically with some of the educational, cultural, and sports activities and exchanges that ECA does. So by setting up a separate department at the Bureau, we were able to partner with companies like Dole in the Philippines, Freeport in Indonesia, Dell in Brazil, Western Union in India, to do more of this very successful English microscholarship program that the Bureau has, which trains underserved kids in English language. And as we all know, English is important not because it's the language that's spoken in the United States, but because it's really the most important economic development tool. It really has an impact on not just that individual, but their greater family. We were able to partner with Intel to provide further IT training for our teachers and for students in Azerbaijan and India. We were able to partner with Avon for an international visitor program on breast cancer and a number of other companies. And I think this is really just the beginning, because as soon as the Bureau works out some of the kinks and the economy improves, I think there's going to be a lot more private sector partners that are going to come on board. Secondly, as many of you know, the mission of the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs is to bring people together and to create mutual understanding. And as we all know, especially those of us who are either young ourselves or who have young kids, the youth especially are spending more and more time on the internet and social networking sites. In fact, you know, there are studies done in the U.S. that says young Americans are now spending just as much time hanging out, quote unquote, with their friends in social networking sites as they are watching TV or actually really hanging out physically with their friends. And we know that this trend is going to cover the entire world. In fact, I actually really saw this firsthand. I was visiting a very remote school in the Mindanao region of the Philippines where this underserved school with 800 kids had only 2 donated computers. The kids sitting in that room using these computers were on Friendster, which is the Asian version of Facebook. They weren't doing anything else. They were on Friendster talking to their kids. So we thought what we really want to do was we want to create a community of people that are interested in international exchanges, international dialogue. We really need to become the master networker in bringing people together who are interested in foreign affairs. And to do this, we said, okay, we got to find an interesting way for young people to come on. So we launched a global video contest that actually wrapped up in March, and I understand there's some great videos out there, and the winners were announced. And that website right now has about 10,000 people from 155 countries in there. And from what I understand, the Bureau is going to work even harder to make this even more viral, to bring even more people on the site. And then, of course, the third thing that we did was to find ways of re-engaging ECA's alumni. ECA has about 1 million alumni all over the world, of which 300 of them are current or former heads of state, including Nicolas Sarkozy of France, Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan, Felipe Calderon of Mexico, and the list goes on. There's 40 Nobel Prize winners, part of ECA's alumni. There's 1,500 cabinet-level ministers. And everybody else that's not on this level is truly a leader in their own community, in their own field, whether they're teachers or they're activists or they run NGOs or they start NGOs or they're business leaders. So this is really a group that we needed to re-engage with to make sure that we were finding other opportunities for them so they can actually become agents of change in their own countries. And we did this by partnering with the private sector. Our partnership with Intel was a way to find other avenues for the teachers that ECA trains to become bigger and better agents of change. And we partnered with NGOs all around the world so that these NGOs could offer further opportunities for these people. So each one of these initiatives that I just talked to you about, you know, obviously they were important in amplifying and massifying some of what ECA does. But I tell you, every one of these was difficult to implement in the confines of the government. And obviously bureaucracy is an issue, as we all know. But I think even more important than bureaucracy, the U.S. government has some legitimate issues that it needs to deal with every one of these new activities and new opportunities. And I just want to give you a few examples of that. You know, to get our public-private partnerships off the ground, you know, obviously we needed to do some market segmentation. We needed to understand exactly what companies we were reaching out to, what are their CSR objectives, what countries are they active on. And then we'd reach out to these companies, and then we would start a dialogue. But as soon as we saw an interest from these companies, that conversation would have to stop because the company had to be vetted. Because obviously the U.S. State Department can't just partner with any company. You know, what if this company has business in front of the State Department? What if we are representing this company in a dispute that they have with a foreign government? What if this company has had issues with bribery charges? What if this company has issues that we're helping them in front of the European Union or any other international organization? So what this meant was that basically this whole process would have to stop until this company got vetted by the ethics office and three other bureaus and until we would get the go-ahead. One of the other initiatives that we worked on was providing this ability to bring a free online English language learning tool to millions of people around the world. I took a trip to Brazil, and the Brazilian Minister of Education said, I have 10 million Brazilian kids that are going to be wired to the internet by 2010. I have no content. And the reason why he has no content is because Brazilian kids don't speak English well enough to be able to connect to the greater internet. So this online English opportunity was really important. And our goal was to go out there and find private sector companies that could partner with the State Department and actually provide this tool to the greater public all over the world. So when you want to partner with a private sector partner, you know, they have to be able to make a business case to their own shareholders. So they would either have to do this out of the goodness of their heart and because of their corporate social responsibility objectives, or they would have to do this because they thought it would help them build new markets. Can the State Department help a company build new markets? I mean, is that an appropriate role for the State Department? Let's say this company was Google, which it was not. We ended up finding two other companies that I think the Bureau is currently going through its due diligence process to see if there's potential for partnership. But let's assume this company was Google. Would Google have been able to place ads on every page that people looked at while they were learning English? Was that an appropriate role for the State Department? And then back to our social networking site. From what I understand, we launched the U.S. government's first branded social networking site. So when you do something like that, think about all the issues you have to deal with. You know, are you going to be able to place cookies on people's computers? Because when you place cookies, you know who people are. Can the U.S. government know who somebody is? When you want people to register on the website, what kind of information can you collect from these people? There's all sorts of privacy issues that are involved. So I came to the conclusion, and I must say, by this time I was ignorant of the 34 other public diplomacy reports that were written. I had probably read one of them. But I came to the conclusion that there were all these opportunities for doing better and bigger public diplomacy for the United States if it could be done within an independent organization or a foundation that would have some kind of a link with the U.S. government, but that would really be able to take advantage of the ingenuity of the private and the nonprofit sector. Of these 34 public diplomacy reports that Rana, in fact, mentioned, 14 of them have recommended the same thing, starting from the Derijian Commission report, Council on Foreign Relations, the Defense Science Board, which the gentleman talked about, the Meridian and the Center of the Study of the Presidency, Kristen Lord's report, when she was at Brookings, and of course the CSIS Smart Power Report. There's also been three congressional bills that have included either a center for either strategic communications or global engagement. These recommendations actually, interestingly enough, have a lot in common. Like, for example, they overwhelmingly suggest that this needs to be a nonprofit, non-governmental, nonpartisan organization that's funded through annual appropriations from U.S. Congress, as well as private sector funding, with very defined accountability metrics. The governance structure needs to include a board that's made up of opinion leaders that come from the business, media, nonprofit sectors, and both political parties. And good models that have been mentioned have been the National Science Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for Democracy. The specific goals are different based on every one of these studies, but most agree that this new organization should really fill in the gaps rather than redo what the U.S. government already does. It doesn't say that you have to go recreate what the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs already does awfully well. But they do have some points in common. You know, they all say that it's important to tap into the ingenuity of the private sector and the nonprofit sector by giving grants, acting as a venture capital provider, as an incubator. And I can just think about all of the ECA alumni that I just talked to you about that would really give their right arm to be able to have access to grants like that. You know, I met a young man in Indonesia, a Muslim, who really wanted to start this independent youth organization that would be focused on promoting moderate Islam. And this list goes on. This is just one example. The second point that they mostly agree on is that it needs to provide a better understanding of foreign publics, just like the ambassador said, through research and polling. I think when we look at the situation in Pakistan nowadays, we can see how important it is to understand foreign publics better because the majority of the Pakistanis now view the insurgency of the Taliban as the U.S.'s war rather than Pakistan's war. So to understand exactly what the Pakistani mindset is made up of makes a huge difference for U.S. public diplomacy. The third thing they all agree on is that this organization, one of its focus should be shaping foreign attitudes on the U.S. through communication strategies. I think we have another example right in front of us today with the issue of the translated Bibles in Afghanistan. You know, Al Jazeera showed this piece about these Bibles that were translated into Dari and Pashto that were in Afghanistan, and so all of a sudden they're portraying the U.S. government and the soldiers as proselytizing, which, of course, is, you know, a complete sin in Islam, and so everybody is up in arms. But there is really no entity out there that is pushing back on this thing that's not true. This is not a fact. And then the fourth one, of course, is focusing on new media and technologies and giving grants to independent filmmakers. Al Jazeera Children's Network, by the way, which is very different than the big Al Jazeera, wanted to do a documentary on some of the Muslim kids that ECA brings to the United States. ECA doesn't have the funds for that. Al Jazeera didn't have the funds for that. But for a program like that to be shown on Al Jazeera Children's TV would have really impacted the image of the United States because just as the ambassador said, these kids are all in love with the U.S. when they come and spend a year here in the United States. And then, of course, fifth, it's mutual exchanges and convening. So, you know, I think clearly there's a lot of experts and practitioners who've come to the same conclusion that there's really a necessity for an independent organization. What I want to propose is that I think it's about time that we stop doing more studies and we actually start implementing all this valuable information that we've gleaned from these great studies that have been done in the past few years. So I would like to propose establishing a coalition of the willing, and I'm reaching out to all of you, if any one of you is interested, who would like to join a coalition like this, so that there can be a group of us that can come together, go to U.S. Congress, talk to everybody else who's interested in this idea, and actually make this a reality. Please come and talk to me after this meeting is over. Thank you so much.
So, can you hear me? Yes? Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. I have the privilege of being the last speaker on the last panel at the end of the day, so I'll try to be as brief as possible. I'm really pleased to join my very distinguished panelists on the subject of public diplomacy today. I have to preface my remarks by saying that these remarks are very much based on the research and work of one of these studies, I think, the CSIS Embassy of the Future Study. So we covered, we talked about our overseas diplomatic presence and recommendations for improving it in that study to include public diplomacy. The project, which culminated now quite some time ago in 2007, fall of 2007, I have to add, was guided by a group of very distinguished commissioners, one of the most distinguished of whom sits to my left on the podium with me, and I hope Ambassador Pickering will feel free to add anything to my remarks that he would care to do. So a little bit about the premise of the Embassy of the Future study, and I think we've heard many of the themes that I'm about to outline already here today. Its vision of the world was really about one in which non-state actors play an increasingly influential role, and in which the job of diplomats is changing. And again, here I'm including those who are in the public diplomacy arena. Traditional diplomacy, a premise where government and social elites interact in highly formal channels, is being transformed, and that even though U.S. diplomats are going to need to continue to influence U.S. Foreign governments, increasingly they're going to have to work with diverse parts of other nations' societies, emerging interest groups, future leaders who shape their nation's values and behavior over the long term. Young populations, we've talked about them, are just now forming their views. We want to know what will those views be 10 years from now, and how do we influence them? So we set forth some principles in the study, and I won't go through all of them, but in general, we premise that the Embassy of the Future, and here I mean the people in the embassy, not the physical structure itself, although I'll talk about that in a moment, our presence should be decentralized within each country. We should have the capacity for mobility. We should have expanded and sustained reach among more communities. And our embassy officials should have the capacity to be connected, should be responsive, and should be informed. Now, in order to do that, we need to give our diplomats new and better tools, and this is really in the nuts and bolts, to do their jobs more effectively. The State Department needs embassy buildings and physical presence that advance American interests, technology that promotes outreach and exchange, building on what's been said here already, and the capacity to sustain risk in the field. None of this is going to be possible without proper resourcing, something we haven't talked a lot about yet today, because projecting U.S. influence through diplomatic engagement requires a serious commitment of funds and must be viewed as a long-term investment. Some modernization, of course, has already begun, and including developments since the report was issued, but a lot more needs to be done. Let me focus on just four key recommendations that must be undertaken to address the challenge of building a strong future diplomacy, and by extension, of course, public diplomacy. First and most immediately, the State Department must fix its personnel deficit and then go on to hire enough people to meet the new challenges of the future. Today's State Department does not have enough people to meet current training needs without causing vacancies in the field, and it has operational deficit positions in the field. The so-called Cold War dividend, in part, led to a drop in spending on foreign affairs overall and to personnel, spending on personnel in the 90s. The drop on spending on personnel was partially offset in the early part of the Bush administration with new hiring under the Diplomatic Readiness Initiative, but that hiring increase was not sustained in most of the later Bush years. In the public diplomacy arena, in 2008, according to the State Department, the difference between public diplomacy requirements and available staff was 13%. We have a 13% vacancy rate. Our commission, and there have been others publications since ours, recommended as a starting point to hire about 1,100 people, just as a starting point to deal with the problem of having to train people without causing these vacancies overseas. This number is it's a relatively small number in the context of our overall national security establishment, yet it represents nearly a 10% increase in Foreign Service personnel. I think that the fiscal year 09 appropriations go a long way toward meeting that increase, and I'm really pleased about that. An important first step to the additional increases which are going to be needed to fill empty slots overseas and to meet new requirements. And I believe there is a proposal for uptick in spending of personnel also in the FY10 budget. So a new challenge that the State Department is going to face is training, not only to meet the new challenges and new ways of doing business that we talked about, but also a significant new influx of additional Foreign Service personnel. They need language skills training more extensively, but also particularly when our foreign service officers are expected to deal in new media and email and other kinds of engagements publicly on television, more and more of them, and radio and other new media, and also new media in a new media. Leadership training, program management, technology, and security skills, just to name a few. This takes money, and also it takes people. Embassy employees native to the host country, what we call Foreign Service Nationals, should be better utilized, our commission concluded. And they should have better training so they're capable of taking on greater responsibility. This has particular relevance for the area of public diplomacy, where Foreign Service Nationals are already in many places in significant positions of responsibility. Second set of recommendations, the State Department must do a better job of exploiting modern technology and new communications tools to conduct its business overseas. We've just heard how there have been some strides made in that area, but again, I think much more needs to be done. And this is illustrated by the fact that as of March 2009, nearly 1.6 billion people use the Internet. This number is going to continue to grow as infrastructure emerges, as all of you know, and costs decline. And historically, the State Department, shall we say, has had a difficult job keeping up in the area of technology. Younger officers we spoke to in the course of doing our research feel this most acutely and are most strident about the need to keep up. Secretary Powell brought desktop internet access to the State Department just in 2001. That was a significant improvement, but think about how long it took to get there. Technology must serve the business of diplomacy and must be matched to the current and future needs of diplomats. Mobile communications devices, which, believe it or not, most of our diplomats still, as far as I know, do not have. The more extensive use of video conferencing, some good examples of which were mentioned today, and modern online forms of communication, blogs and social networking. We only found one example of social networking throughout the world when we did our research in the summer of 2007, and it was on Friendster in Indonesia, must be utilized, and they must be tailored, of course, to the needs of our embassies in each country. These must be expanded to extend diplomats' reach and capacity and to widen their networks, as we've already heard. The Obama administration has already made a very public move, I think, to bring the utilization of new media certainly to the White House in the form of its first town hall. And I hope that some of the steps that have been taken at the State Department will be significantly expanded. It's absolutely critical. Third, as I talked about decentralization, diplomats cannot afford to be overly centralized in their presence. They need to be able to operate from what we call distributed platforms, places away from the embassy, with mobility, close to the people that they need to be with, their target audiences. They need to have technology that allows them to be mobile, training that ensures they have the language capacity. They need security awareness and resources for travel, representation, and administrative support. And you would be surprised to learn how often we talk to people who complained that while they were ready to travel, they simply didn't have the travel funds to support what it was that they wanted to do. And again, in relative terms of our national security budget, not large sums of money. Our embassy buildings should represent the best of America. The new embassy building program must continue, and the State Department must construct safe, secure, and modern structures, but these structures also need to reflect American values. And any of you who've traveled overseas recently has probably seen one of these new embassies. They're frequently referred to as fortresses, and they're often outside of city centers. In the course of our interviews, we heard clearly the negative effect of the new embassy construction program on public diplomacy activities. Here's a quote. "I have to say we are in this beautiful space, and we like that. We do have to overcome how far we are from downtown. You do feel like Fortress America. I know there are valid security concerns, and I don't know what the answer is, but we need to keep thinking about it." Our image, I think, should be one of confidence and pride, not fear and retreat. And we need to think about this as we continue the new embassy construction program, optimizing it not only for cost and security, but also for our business practices and diplomatic needs. These new embassies, as I said, built often at a distance from city centers and with little space for public events, have had a significant impact on the public diplomacy toolkit and, frankly, on interchange with individuals from the private sector. Anecdotally, we know that our distant embassies dissuades people from dropping in and meeting with U.S. officials. People want to come, but it's just much more difficult. The barrier has been raised. Together with the closing of many of our consulates and our libraries in the 1990s, these changes demand new approaches to developing outreach, again, tailored to each nation. This means expanding options where we can for a variety of newer kinds of platforms. Developing over the past few years. So we have established now an increasing number of what we call American presence posts. These are one or two presence posts that are placed outside of city centers. These were pioneered in France, and they perform a number of important functions, not consular, but among those functions, often public diplomacy. We need to fund our circuit riders appropriately, people from the embassy who can travel around on a regular basis and visit major centers of interest routinely. We need to fund and support our American Corners, which are partnerships with local universities and other host nation institutions that provide information and access to U.S. cultural activities and information and so forth and so on. And where possible, and I say where possible, reopening American centers, which at one time were a flagship public diplomacy presence for the United States in many countries and created easy access for people in the nations in which we were represented. Another new type of post that we established over toward the end of the Bush administration over the past few years are called the virtual presence posts. These are posts which are established as a website, essentially, oriented toward a particular city outside a capital. And they provide information that will be of interest to people in that city. And they are theoretically coupled with regular visits to that city. But what we found is that there are two ways these virtual presence posts need to be strengthened to be really effective. One is that the travel to these places, in fact, needs to be routine, and oftentimes other press of business minimized the travel more than those involved in supporting the virtual presence post would have liked. And they also need to provide opportunities for exchange and interchange online. They can't just be brochureware. So I think there is a great possibility there, but it needs to be utilized effectively. All of these options have potential if they are developed and implemented and funded wisely and consistently. Fourth, and then finally, this is my last point, the State Department's culture and practices should continue their transition away from risk avoidance and toward risk management. As one senior Foreign Service officer told us in one of our interviews, we may have locked the bad guys out, but we have locked ourselves in. The problem of managing risk in a world that has become more dangerous over the past few years for Americans is a serious challenge, and it's going to require a serious conversation on the part of the Secretary of State, within the State Department, with the Congress, and among all interested parties. Some ways to deal with this issue is better and more security skills training made available to diplomats and their families so that ambassadors and DCMs feel comfortable that their people have the training to go to places that may pose more risk. And our security experts, frankly, must be well-trained in the language and the culture of the nations in which they serve, as well as in the underlying practices of diplomacy, so they can better understand the purposes for which they are designing security plans and systems and providing guidance and advice to the people who serve, the officials who serve in these embassies. In closing, I think I have to say it is hard to overstate the importance of these reforms. As the director of State Department Policy Planning, Anne Marie Slaughter, noted in her article in Winter 2009 Foreign Affairs, we live in a networked world. Diplomacy is networked, war is networked, and our media are networked. We need a State Department that can function effectively and accomplish our diplomatic objectives in this 21st century networked environment. If our diplomats are not given the tools they need to engage on a very broad range of host nation audiences, they will become irrelevant. We will not be able to tap into private sector connections that are so rich and so vital to our ability to engage with other nations. I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak, and I look forward to your questions and to our discussion. Thank you.
Okay, thanks to all the panelists. Can my team, Carol and Michael, what time do we have Michael showing up to conclude? 10 minutes for questions. In that case, please keep your questions short, very short. Identify yourselves and let us know to whom you're directing the question or whether it's to the entire panel. I think that was the first hand to go up. I'm sorry, brown suit. Yes.
My name is Tara Campbell. I'm with the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and my question is actually for the whole panel, sort of coming from the comments from Ann Witkowski. You're talking about the need to modernize the State Department, make it more nimble, effective, relevant. Were there any recommendations in terms of the screening process, the hiring process to work for not only the State Department, but government in general, that seems to be a little bit rigid, perhaps exclusionary, you know, hearkening back to the previous panel's comments on how admissions decisions are made. It seems to be a relatively similar situation, that it's based on a test and exclusion and weeding certain people out. Were there recommendations, and are there any movements afoot that you know of to perhaps streamline and might I say, modernize the selection process there?
While we were conducting the study, there was indeed another study internal to the State Department that was being undertaken at the same time. It was principally on competencies that would be needed for the future diplomat. And also during that period, there were revisions underway to the Foreign Service exam. And I will turn the mic over to our senior diplomat here to talk about that. So we referred by reference, but we didn't undertake this.
I would just very briefly say that the State Department has been struggling for years about the long time between exams and the long time it takes to bring people on board. Some new and original ideas, which are not breathtaking but are important, was to put the exam online, let people take it as they see fit, and then try to find ways to compress the time once they'd pass the exam between that particular benchmark and when they were actually taking it. I don't know how well they have done with this. I suspect it's got to be better than what it was in the past, and I think that that's moved forward. Another thing, and I was very much honored by Secretary Albright, who named, in fact, an existing program after me, but it's essentially the State Department ROTC program in every sense of the word. It provides up to 4 years of undergraduate and graduate training. And the idea was to reach out for people who couldn't afford on their own to do the necessary preparation, and the requirement is to pass the State Department Foreign Service exam at some point during the training, and then to serve 5 years. And I think it seems to be an equitable and really good program. But I've been impressed because I see a lot of these people, about the way in which that program has reached out. Obviously, it has reached out to minorities. The courts have said you can't have only minorities in the program, but it has worked hard. Minorities are disadvantaged in terms of having the funds in general to meet these requirements. So I think it's been a very useful way of making the Foreign Service a great deal more like our country rather than a more exclusionary thing. So I gets at two of your points, but I think we have a ways to go.
Thank you. My name is Marianne Scott, and I am actually a former USIA and State Department public diplomacy officer, and I've spent the past 7 years working with families who have lost loved ones to terrorism and are responding by reaching out internationally. And Ambassador Pickering, I like the way you think. The idea of a standalone agency within State Department really caught my attention and brought things together. I started thinking about many things, but I have two issues I'd like to ask anyone on the panel if you'd be willing to address. One of them is the whole interface with citizen diplomacy. One of the things that I've seen since I've left the department is how vibrant and how widespread the whole citizen diplomacy movement is, and how there's such a possibility there to work more closely between the public diplomacy function and the citizen diplomacy function, which are distinct, but there's a lot of interface there. And the other is the role of public diplomacy that's not just State Department, so that public diplomats in particular representing, looking at what other parts of government and other agencies in government do, and how if you kind of silo it off in State Department, what implications might that have? Two very different questions.
Could I very briefly, and then others may want to do it, I would say amen certainly on the last one. Another reason to have an agency that's across the board, even if it is in state, is that it can represent the whole of government, I think much more effectively than individual state bureaus fractioned around the State Department can. So I think that makes a lot of sense. On the other, there was a study done for Secretary Rice called Transformational Diplomacy, and a number of us worked on it. And we were very impressed, all of us, inside and out the side of government, where many people with very little government experience, on the absolute need to create in the State Department something that AID had begun, which was a separate organization to deal with, in effect, across the board, the public aspects, what we call the private aspects, and how they relate to the public. And so it was designed to deal with NGOs, with academia, with certainly all aspects of citizen diplomacy, with major corporations, with labor unions, because we all recognized that this was a rapidly changing world, and these were all playing a huge role. And it seemed to me that while it was obvious that the State Department had a bureau to deal with Congress, it should have a bureau to deal with these other efforts that were coming forward and pull them together, understand how you could create synergies, and how could you relate to them. In Maine, many of the functional bureaus of the State Department have their own constituencies in these areas, but it isn't like having what I would call an across-the-board address some of them. And I think this is important. So far, that's one of the many dead letter recommendations, but we hope the new administration will look at.
Maybe I'll just add a couple of words to that, because I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I was asked when I was at ECA regarding the possibility of citizen diplomats. But the fact is that ECA that I am familiar with just doesn't have the resources or really the time to be able to deal with something that's not part of its regular everyday purview. But I think, in my opinion, that kind of strengthens the argument for this independent organization, that it can actually give grants to wonderful, creative individuals that really have bright ideas for reaching out to foreign publics, that, you know, what they're really looking for is for an organization that would be able to provide support for them.
And then finally, I just add, maybe this is what you're referring to, used to be that the U.S. government had a more effective mechanism for knowing when these citizen diplomats were traveling to other countries and to facilitate their visits there. And in our commission, there was a call for trying to reestablish that mechanism. It could be almost any place, but it's clear, there's clearly a need for it.
Len, did you have a question? Your hand was up early.
Yeah, I'm Len Baldiga with Public Diplomacy Council, IREX, and several other organizations. Spent 33 years in public diplomacy and all around the world. Question on these studies. I read all 30-something, and 30 years ago there were 30-some studies. So this has been going on for some time. And somewhat outside the box, 33% of the exchanges currently conducted by AID, only 13% over at ECA. Why not combine AID and USIA into some agency for public diplomacy and development? Then you'd get a larger organization and, I think, probably more effective organization in dealing with some of these issues.
Lynn, it's a very interesting proposal. You never cease to come forward with interesting proposals anyway. My own feeling is that each of these has a kind of quality that requires, in my view, focus and concentration across the wide range, so that public diplomacy is exchanges, but not all exchanges. And development has exchanges, but it is not all exchanges. And so one of the things that I tried to do at various posts, and it's looking at the problem through the other end of the microscope, is to create under my DCM a group that dealt with all exchanges, so that in Russia, all the people who were exchanged by the military, by AID, by USIA, by any other program we supported, got put into the mix, got part of the plan. We kept down poaching. We tried to avoid double dipping on people, but we also tried to fill holes so that if, in fact, it looked like we were taking all one group of people and not others, we went back to the folks and said, can you look a little harder over here? To see, in fact, if we can broaden out the exchanges arrangements so we cover those pieces of the foreign government or foreign society that are very much in our interest. And I think that's one way to get at it. It's not a perfect way, but I think the disadvantages of creating an agency only around exchanges is that there are tails of that that reach off into other parts of our activity that have to be considered.
I'll add one comment to that, and I think the ambassador tried to solve it on the ground, which is often the most effective way to do things. But there was a GAO report among the 34 issued just after the election in November and making 13 recommendations to the incoming administration and the Congress about areas across the government that needed attention. Public diplomacy was one of those areas, and one of the recommendations, it made several, I won't dwell on them, but one of them, and this is a consistent theme through a number of reports, has been that we need to do a better job of interagency coordination, looking at programs conducted by the military, by AID, by USIA, and elsewhere in the government that, as the ambassador said, seemingly operate independently of one another. So let's hope that the new administration takes a look at that kind of process. Second comment I would like to add, for the benefit of folks who are here from the U.S. side of international education, I know we've got a lot of universities represented. I apologize for not having somebody on this panel from the Department of Education, International Department, to talk about some of the work that you do through Title VI. We will cover that the next time around. I think we've reached our limit. May I allow one more question? And then, okay. The lady in the back.
I'm Carol Blight from the College Board. And in talking about the tools of diplomacy, I didn't hear the Education USA Advising Centers as one of those tools.
It's an unbelievable tool. Can you hear me?
Yes.
It's one of the best tools that ECA has. And in fact, one of the things that we worked on really hard in this past year is to make sure that they're actually all branded as Education USA Advising Centers, and that, you know, folks know that this is really, they're there with the major support from the Department of State. So huge tool. Can't say enough about it.
Okay. Thank you very much for your patience. It's late in the day. We have, and I'm going to have Michael come. We'll stay seated and bring Michael McCary up, who is the Executive Director of the Alliance for Educational and Cultural Exchange. He is going to do our concluding remarks, and then we will free you all to go relax in a brief cocktail hour.
Okay, is this working?
Yeah.
Well, I have, to paraphrase Ann Witkowski, the really daunting role of being the last speaker after the last panel. And I, apart from that, two big challenges. One is to provide a summation of almost 6 hours of very rich content, and the second, perhaps even more challenging, is to do it briefly. I promise I will, because I'm acutely aware I'm all that's standing between you and a glass of wine. I want to start with Senator Hagel. He kept talking about frameworks and kept making frameworks, and I was surprised at a symposium to talk about the Obama administration that we heard a lot about President Eisenhower. And as I thought about, reflected on that in the little time I've had to do that, it struck me as a particularly appropriate reference. You remember Senator Hagel stressed Eisenhower's emphasis on creating alliances, an international engagement through alliances. And the senator tied that to the present day by saying every issue we face is global. And as he talked about how we approach this, it was very clear. He said things like, I'm paraphrasing a bit, we need to approach others with humility. We need to search out and look for our common humanity and then engage with people on the basis of what we called our samenesses. And I think that's a pretty good prescription for this set of tools we're talking about, international education and exchange. And I think it ties in very, very well with the rhetoric we've heard so far from the Obama administration, from the president, the Secretary of State particularly. I want to pick up maybe four key themes from the day in the other panels. One is that emerged most clearly in the Zogby Goodman panel that opened the program with Rick Barton, was the changing paradigm, the sense that it's not just moving, as Alan Goodman says, not just increasing numbers of American students staying abroad or foreign students coming here. It's a rethinking of what an educated person is, that an international dimension has to be part of an education. And Mr. Zogby made the point that the new generation and their parents are now demanding this, so that we're all going to be forced to change in ways we perhaps can't anticipate now because young people and their families are going to demand it of us. The second point I want to make came from the audience. It seems to me what I was hearing was that there clearly needs to be an expansion of participation opportunities for the American public. And this was phrased largely in terms of foreign language learning and access to study abroad opportunities, particularly for those in our society who are less advantaged. That's clearly a very big priority for the future. I think, realistically, probably all of that can't be federally funded, but certainly more can be done in the federal government. And I think academic institutions, again, going back to Mr. Zogby's notion of demand driving these activities, that's going to be really important. The third theme, clearly, from this afternoon and all day, really, mobility, international mobility is a complex and rapidly changing picture. Rajika Bhandari made the point that global international mobility is growing, 2.9 million internationally mobile students at the moment. That might almost triple by the year 2025. U.S. numbers are good, both inbound and outbound, compared to previous levels, but our market share has reduced. And there's clearly we need to get more American students overseas, and we have capacity, the greatest absorptive capacity in the world, to bring in more international students, and there are plenty of benefits for that. It's also was clear in David Payne's outline of some megatrends that there's much stiffer competition for these students, and as Alan Goodman pointed out, lots of countries now have their own foreign policies about international education. This is clearly a lucrative game, not merely for the dollars students bring in. That $15 billion number was cited today, and that's one that keeps rising on an annual basis as the U.S. Department of Commerce figure. But more importantly, I think, and that was reflected in the comments today, in terms of the national benefit of having a diverse group of international students here who in some cases stay here and help our economy grow and drive technological change, and in many other cases go home with an impression, a deep impression of the United States that's usually a positive impression, as Ambassador Pickering said, and who are friends and cooperators and partners with the U.S. throughout a career in leadership in any of a number of fields because, every issue is global. And I was particularly struck by Rajika Mandari's use of the phrase unusual suspects in terms of this the competition there. She said Malaysia, Jordan, Singapore, China, and Japan as countries now with active and very detailed policies about attracting foreign students because they see it in their broad interest. Nathan Bell pointed out that 16% of our graduate students are non-U.S. citizens and that 31% of doctorates of research doctorates are non-U.S. citizens, in all fields. And we talked a little bit about the impact, of course. We anticipate there's an understanding and an appreciation, I think, for people in this field that in most cases the impact of this is very positive. The point was made that we haven't had enough qualitative research on that. And Alan Goodman cited the example of a memorable anecdote for me since I went to Notre Dame of the woman from Southern Cal who in the Chador saying, she's a proud Trojan. And I guess that's okay in terms of the national interest, but I would have preferred she'd gone to Notre Dame. Finally, public diplomacy. I think while there wasn't consensus on the panel of what the precise change or reform or restructuring needs to be, there was pretty clearly consensus that there needs to be some change. Ambassador Pickering's call for a standalone agency, Assistant Secretary Mayer's call for an independent organization, and Witkowski's discussion, a very informed discussion about structuring and resource issues and how that affects various things about how the Foreign Service functions and how effectively it does. Quickly to finish, we talked, it seemed to me, this is a symposium about the Obama administration and how these issues are going to play out in the administration. Of course, we can't talk much about that yet or in a very informed way because the Obama administration is just getting started. And I think a lot of what we did was to talk about, I think in a very informative and provocative in some cases way, talked about the environment in which the Obama administration is going to be operating. And I know there are people from the department in the room, and I hope some of these this goes back to the department, and I'm sure it will. But in terms of thinking about how for all of us on the outside to observe the administration and see how it's doing vis-a-vis some of the things, I've teased out a few questions that I think I heard in the course of the day. One is, and this, Witkowski made this mostly, resources clearly are critical. We don't know how the resources are going to look. Congress has to act. Tomorrow we'll know something because the president's budget is going to be released, and we'll see the budget detail for the first time on funding for State Department exchange programs, education-related development activities, and the international programs of the Department of Education. And one of the things, and of course, we're all hopeful that those numbers, the budget request, which starts the appropriations process, that those numbers will be good. One of the things I think in the exchange world it'll be particularly important is what kind of – will the numbers be sufficient to allow for broader geographic reach than we now have? For understandable reasons, and the exchange community supported this, a large percentage of the exchange budget, State Department exchange budget, now goes to the Middle East or Muslim world. I would argue, and many would, that areas like the republics of the former Soviet Union, Africa, South America are perhaps a bit underfunded, and we need to be reaching out more to those. So that's one place where resources could help in the exchanges world. Another critical element is leadership. Judith McHale's been named as the Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. The Assistant Secretary of State for Educational and Cultural Affairs has not yet been named. But who that person is and what they develop as their priorities will be critical to how this plays out. There's a consensus among our panel here and among many in Washington that operational structure is critical. People differ on what the right remedy is, but I think a question to watch is how the Obama administration will approach this. Will it undertake to make a change in that regard, and which way will it go? And finally, and I think we heard this from the audience repeatedly and from panelists, the American public is critical. Globally literate citizens are a national security interest for the United States. We need our children need to be able to operate in a globalized world. And I know a globalized world is a cliche, but cliches become cliches for a reason. And it's true. And if our kids are going to, our students now and those coming up, are going to be effective as leaders in the world in whatever field of work they do, they're going to need to understand the world. And so we need to find ways, both within the exchange budget and the activities funded by the federal government and in other activities outside that, including those that are done through public institutions or with private funding, to find ways to get more young Americans overseas in substantive experiences, to understand foreign cultures and understand foreign languages. That's the end of my summation. I want to just take 90 more seconds to thank my colleagues in the Alliance, both our membership and staff, our friends at CSIS and ETS for putting together this program. And now I think I can invite you all to step next door and have that glass of wine. Thank you very much for participating.